ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with one of your boys, Corbin Middlemass, in today. There is no Ed Cowan. He's taking a well-earned break, as we say in the industry. There's no such thing as a cricket off-season. The IPL, obviously, ongoing at the moment. Ed's going to just try and take a little bit of time off and recharge the batteries. During that time, when Ed isn't here, I'll be joined by some of the heavy hitters in Australian cricket. So if there's a special guest in particular that you want to hear from on this podcast, of course, your favourite cricket podcast, you can hit us up at ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au. That's ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au. And I haven't forgotten, by the way, about Ed and his all-time ODI team. So we'll hold him to that. First up today, the guests don't get too much bigger than this. A man who we talk about all the time here, along with his two selection buddies in Andrew McDonald and Tony Dottomade. My guest today is the chief selector of the Australian cricket team, George Bailey. We talk about the relationship between the team and the press, which we debate, obviously, ongoing here on the ABC Cricket Podcast.
People might have different opinions on whether the documentaries being there or not being there is a good thing. I certainly feel like the access to players and the amount of press they do, and then individually with some different podcasts and their own social media accounts, I think you still get a tremendous insight as to where players are at.
The past player criticisms directed at him and at the team more broadly, how that impacts him.
I don't perhaps always say it this way, but it's a strength. We don't get the benefit of hindsight. I guess everyone watching and critiquing, they do get that.
Who might be the next cab off the rank for the Australian cricket team? And the contract list, which was released last Wednesday. Who got in, who missed out, and what the team is prioritising over the next 12 months.
There's no doubt at times we're going to have to go deeper than that. I think always with those contract lists, it's trying to strike the balance of rewarding those that have performed well in that men's team, particularly across the test space and with what's coming up with the test schedule and also trying to make sure that you've got all bases covered and a nice balance across that list.
So here it is, my chat with the chief selector, George Bailey. Former three-format cricketer for Australia, a man who captained his country on many occasions in the white ball format. He is now the chief selector of the Australian cricket team. George Bailey joins me on the ABC Cricket Podcast. George, appreciate your time.
Howdy, Cole.
Squad's out, so we learnt that when it came through on Wednesday. What are your key takeaways from the contract list that Cricket Australia released?
I think looking forward and understanding that it's a really busy schedule, and the contract list is a starting point. There's no doubt at times we're going to have to go deeper than that. I think always with those contract lists, it's trying to strike the balance of rewarding those that have performed well in that men's team, particularly across the test space and with what's coming up with the test schedule and also trying to make sure that you've got all bases covered and a nice balance across that list.
You mentioned as part of it that you have had a leniency towards a longer format of the game, putting this contract list together, given the fact that there's so many test matches in the next 12-month window. So the only three guys that I'm looking at here that are specifically white ball players at the moment, Mitch Marsh, who of course has played red ball cricket in the not-too-distant past, Adam Zampa and Nathan Ellis. It means there's no Glenn Maxwell, there's no Tim David. Is that their choice? Is that your choice as to how that comes about, obviously, with the advent of franchise cricket and so many other options 12 months of the year? How did it come about to leave a couple of those sort of white ball specialists off the list?
I think it's looking ahead with what the 12 months is, and clearly I think it's potentially 2021, but 20 tests in the next 12 months. Effectively, it's the red ball focus is going to be huge. But also understanding that at the back end of that, we launch into a 50-over World Cup, and then and 28 is a home T20 World Cup as well. No idea where the Olympics fit in that at the moment. Haven't got any information. You might have more on that than me.
I'm still chasing up.
but I guess they're three of the key pillars around that white ball team. There's certainly other, very important members of multi-format players in that list as well.
Do you know, is there actually a cut-off date for the Olympic qualification? Are you guys aware of when that has to be, like when you need to be ranked in a certain position or to automatically qualify?
No idea.
It's crazy.
No, I'd love to know.
It's crazy, isn't it? That the whole cricket world seemingly in the same boat with that. Jake Weatherall's part of it. Sam Constance isn't. Is that an indication as to what's going to happen the next time the team rolls out in the white clothing in Darwin, that Jake Weatherall will be the opener as he is the incumbent?
He is the incumbent. Obviously with the playing a part across the Ashes, across the summer, also rewarding his consistent performance across a couple of years of domestic cricket as well. Not shying away from the fact that, I think there were a couple of things technically that were targeted and potentially exposed across that Ashes period. But we think he can play, and I think he's got a good opportunity now. He's going to head across to Leicester and have a little stint over there. And in and around that, a good chunk of time where he can get really busy with the coaching staff and, in particular, Michael Divenuto in that batting space to focus on that. I won't lock him into that Bangladesh series. I think we've been pretty consistent. We'll pick a team when we need to pick a team. We've got a number of camps across the winter as well, again, which will, encompass a range of players inside and outside that contract list. He'll be a part of that and we'll work to that closer.
What should we expect from, I guess, the makeup of those teams? Like people would say, hey, this is a top-end series against Bangladesh. It's an opportunity to get a glimpse into the future. Do you look at it more as, this will be a not a development team, because obviously when you wear the baggy green, it's never that. But is it likely to be a full-strength, fully loaded Australian team for that first test in August?
Yeah, well, we treat every test match as that. Now, within that, how that shapes up balance-wise. We haven't done a great deep dive into potential conditions up there. We had a little bit of A cricket in the top end last year, some red ball cricket. We've obviously been up in that part of the world for some white ball cricket as well. So we know the grounds. I would hate to toy with the idea of treating any test match as a development opportunity, and particularly, I think that's that would be unfair to the players too, who invest so much into. As you said, it's not easy to play Test cricket, and they need to be rewarded for that.
Your coach was on radio in Melbourne a couple of days ago and spoke about Webster and Green, and that he can see them both playing in the same team in the middle order. He did also preface that by saying, look, I haven't spoken to my fellow selectors yet. I get the opportunity here to speak to one of them. Is that how you see it, given Usman Khawaja's retirement and the fact that there is a spot at number five? Do you see the potential that, that middle order includes both Webster and Green?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've been on record as saying that those two can play on the same team in the past as well. I don't see it as a hindrance, the fact that they both have a skill set across the bat and ball. Hopefully they both are available to be at the bowling crease by that stage of the year. That'd be helpful. But again, it'll be striking the balance of what we need. I guess specifically, yes, to Uzi or that number five spot opening up. I think we've seen Cam bat across a range of positions. I know he probably didn't quite get the output that he would have liked across the Aussie summer, but even thinking back to the tricky wickets in the West Indies, and again, not massive scores, but in terms of contributions and percentage of runs in what were winning totals, he did really well. So he certainly got the skill set to do that. Alex Carey is another one, I think, who he's gone up to six. He's got some flexibility there too. I guess the starting point is they can absolutely both play on the same team.
Can he bat five, Alex Carey?
I reckon he could. Whether it suits the balance and understanding that he on the back of spending however long he may need to in the field, and most of it up to the stumps now, he seems to be loving that. What an incredible summer he's had.
Congratulations on the Ashes. I mean, a 4-1 series victory at any time is absolutely worthy of celebration, and certainly I think Australian cricket fans appreciated that. Andrew McDonald spoke about the review, and I think in the radio interview with Jared Waitley, he even had it in front of him and spoke about the subcategories and the training and preparation and all the different areas. Can you give us a little insight as to how that review went?
Yeah, I mean, we review every major series, so it's not like it was a special touch point or anything. So it was just, going through. No, I certainly don't have it in front of me, Corb. Apologies for that. unprepared, but yeah, going through the same sort of 4, 5, 6 sort of major headlines, and just reviewing. And no two series are the same, so I think there's always little bits you take out of it. I think that, you know, certainly from my area in the selection management, one of, you know, the big thing that we try and look back on is just to make sure we, you know, was there anything we missed? Were there any sort of questions or challenge ourselves sort of moments that we didn't foresee? And yeah, the Ashes, it was. The planning for that would have started 12 or 14 months before. You obviously tighten it up as you go, but even as close as probably a month out, compared to how that series played out and the personnel that we ended up having available at different times, some of the guys to step in, some of the late moving parts, even on the morning of games. So you know, your best laid plans can often be thrown out, but I think what was most pleasing was you know, how well guys were able to step in and step into some different roles, step in and perform and step in and help that team win. And, you know, it's probably two summers in a row where, the Indian Test Series and the Ashes, just the scrutiny and the interest in it's been phenomenal. And I think, you know, that's awesome. And so to see the players weather that, absorb that with all the different changes that were happening and then come out the other side with a 4-1 victory was very satisfying. They did well.
Obviously, we're part of that in what we do on this podcast and certainly in our analysis of the team. I mean, it feels like certainly coming out of Cape Town, there was this Amazon series and it was about showcasing the personalities of the Australian cricket team and who the guys are. And obviously, we've seen less of that in recent times. And it feels like there's been a conscious decision to try and keep the walls a little bit higher. Is that player driven? Is that led by you guys as a selection panel? What can you tell us about that? The fact that, and is that part of it, the way that what you're alluding to there, that the criticism or the scrutiny feels like it's as sharp as it has been?
No, not at all. I mean, people might have different opinions on whether the documentaries being there or not being there is a good thing. I certainly feel like the access to players and the amount of press they do, and then individually with some different podcasts and their own social media accounts, I think you still get a tremendous insight as to where players are at. There's probably a focus at certain times within the team to try and, you know, when you do get a day or two in between tests, to try and really protect around that, and understanding that you obviously see the physical output within a game, but then also that for players, it's a home summer, but you only get to potentially stay at your house once for the majority of players. So just understanding the little connection point there with family and friends is also critical, and just being able to freshen up, knowing that it's coming again. And the opposition's hard. So there's been a conscious effort, I think, at different times to protect a day or two. But I think the access is really high. I still think players are pretty good. I mean, a lot of that potentially comes down to the individual personalities of certain players and where they're at and what they're willing to share.
Is this stuff we can do better, do you think, as the press?
I don't know, mate. I think internally, we always think that it's your good times. You're never going as well as you sometimes are built up to be externally, and vice versa. When things don't go well and you have a bad game or a bad series, things aren't as dire as they seem to be as well. So it's probably just the a keeping of the balance and understanding that, like anything, you know, particularly in sport, that the, there's natural ebbs and flows, and it's not certainly in a player's career or a player's series, it's not linear where there's just this constant performance, and they're, you know, always working and on trying to perform better and trying to fit their role in the team, like we are as staff, in, you know, in terms of constantly trying to evolve with the team as well.
We've seen, I think there was an article by Tom Deason recently where he exchanged, or detailed his exchange with Cam Green following that, that Sheffield Shield game. Is that a concern in the, I guess, the relationship between the player and the press, and then also Cam more specifically as how he's going as you know, such an asset for Australian cricket as a guy who's about to embark on a pretty long and sometimes difficult IPL campaign?
No, I mean, I haven't spoken to Cam directly about that. I imagine, and you know him, you would have spoken to him many times across his journey. It's I'm very comfortable in saying it's an out of character reaction from him. So that's, yeah, that's something that he'll potentially reflect and speak to you know, at some point. But no, I think for the vast majority. Using Tom as an example, we've had a number of away trips. I think the generally the cricket writers that tour, I think everyone gets along well with them, and you know, everyone just understanding that players have a job to do, the press have a job to do, and you know, if that works well in, you know, together, I think everyone benefits.
You've copped your fair share of criticism too for. Yeah, but again, I'm not trying to blow smoke here, but it's sort of, you've had great results clearly in your time as chief selector, and yet, you know, former players have been critical as, you know, whether you're able to make hard calls on players, and I guess the nature of your job is we don't get to see the hard calls that you do make, obviously, behind the scenes in the conversations that you have. We only obviously get a chance to judge on what the team looks like when it goes out there. How do you go with that as a former player? You know, often the criticism's coming from guys that either you played with or that are, you know, past members of the Australian cricket team. How do you go handling that while also trying to, you know, follow the vision and continue on the path that obviously you have for this team?
I think fundamentally it's a... I don't perhaps always say it this way, but it's a strength. You know, I can't recall ever being in a situation with this team where it feels like if we don't send this 11 out, we can't win the game. So again, it's probably just not so binary around black and white of this is the 11 that can win. I think the coaching staff and playing group have bought into the and have built up a system where they like to think that there's different ways that they can win a game, and part of that will be the way your team's structured, part of that will be the opposition and clearly the surface at different times as well, and being flexible within that. So, you know, we don't get the benefit of hindsight. I guess everyone watching and critiquing, they do get that. But, you know, I don't think we've ever been in a situation to say where, I don't want to use specific examples, but player X gets a tight selection call going his way. Now, it's not to say that we also don't believe that if we'd gone with player Y, that we also wouldn't have got the same result. It might have been done differently, but we can still win the game that way. So I try and see it as a strength that, you know, it's great that there are other options and people are publicly backing other options. You know, I imagine in some cases there's some bias around why people are certain, you know, have certain fondness for players that aren't in the team. But it's, you know, it's a strength. Hopefully that continues, and hopefully the Australian cricket team continues to have options when it's picking 11s or picking squads.
Just on hindsight, if you had your time again, would you play a frontline spinner in Sydney?
No, but. You could. I mean, yeah. I mean, that's. I think we can continue to debate that. We debated it right up until the morning of the game. Our starting position is that we don't like not picking a spinner. We like picking a spinner. We don't. I think when we're putting a Test 11 together, the starting premise is there will be a spinner in it, but not trying to fight. Not trying to fight the conditions just to prove a point at different times, but again, that, I mean, that's probably a good example of one where, yeah, I think we could have played a spinner, and I would like to think that we will get the same result. The game might have played out differently, but hopefully you could still execute that.
In recent times on the schedule, the test summer's been starting in Perth. I noticed as one of the subheadings in that Ashes review, it was sort of training and preparation. I think you're a fascinating watch in your team and how it's presented in Perth. So 2 years in a row, split results, 1-1, lost one. I think clearly if you look back on the India series, the team warmed into it. And clearly, you know, with a better team by the time the five test series ended against India. But it didn't start well and you copped a lot of criticism there. Then also when you look at what happened here, it was a fast and frenetic test match and ultimately another worldly innings from Travis Head separated the two teams. You had a player breakdown in the match. You had players that didn't get to the start line. There's also the added element of the time difference and the fact it's on the other side of the country and guys are sometimes coming off white ball schedules or whatever it turns out to be. Have you refined that or have you reviewed? Like, what's the best way to be able to start in Perth to make sure that the best version of the Australian cricket team is the one we get in the first red ball test of the summer?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think there is a perfect prep. I think if there was, you'd just replicate that in every time. So there's a number of factors. I think it depends what you've got in and around that test series, what guys have been coming up off. Have they got enough body of work to be able to perform their role, particularly around the fast bowlers and making sure they've got up to the intensity or miles in the legs, if you want to call it that. As you said, we lost a couple in the lead up this year, which is never ideal. And then there's other years where on the back of a lot of cricket, you might be trying to massage them in. I haven't sort of looked back on that and said that we won the game, so the preparation for this year was good and last year's preparation wasn't good because we lost the game. I think there's things that happen within a game that affect that anyway. I think both games had some individual circumstances that blew the game in the directions that they went. That is part of the review. It's part of the planning process when you go forward what does it look like? And we're already looking at what does it look like for the start of this summer. I think we've got a reasonable block of white ball cricket against England leading into the four tests against New Zealand. So that'll be different again around how we manage that, the individuals within that and how they're tracking. And, it is very much making sure that you've got the individuals where they need to be and not just a one-size-fits-all for everyone. So that's constantly been refined. It gets refined late because you get your moving parts. That's basically, I think, a good snapshot of what the work that we've been doing over the last month and will continue to do is building out camps across the winter with the gap, knowing that once this month, basically from the top end series onwards, it's nuts. And, there's a period here. We'll still have guys playing overseas. We'll have a group of guys that are getting a little bit of rest and prep time in now, individuals are going to be everywhere and doing everything and switching between red and white ball and or coming in for white ball, coming in for red ball. So just getting that balance right is always a challenge, and not always, I guess, the outcome doesn't always reflect that.
One thing we've debated a lot here has been the selection philosophy around specialised batting positions in terms of, openers versus middle order players. And, some have worked well, some haven't worked as well. When it turns out, when you look back on the Australian test team for guys that have come in various spots, and Travis Head's probably proof the other way that he's a guy that can go from the middle order up the top and have success. The T20 team, Steve Smith obviously not playing, and a lot of the reasoning given for that is that he's an opener. He's not a middle order player. So I guess from a selection philosophy point of view, do you see batting positions more specific in the T20 game than you do in the test arena?
No, not necessarily. I think it's you're potentially trying to break down a long stereotype, but again, that's part of, I think, what Pat and Mitch through captaining these teams and in conjunction with the coaching staff and management around the Australian team is trying to build teams that have some inherent flexibility or adaptability and that can change either before a game or within a game that can help you get momentum going your way. And I think that's, I don't think that'll necessarily happen overnight, but that's a work in progress. Can we develop batters that can? And knowing that conditions, we've seen Travis do it for a number of years in the subcontinent where we feel he's best suited at the top. And then when the opportunity was there, it looks like it works quite nicely in Australia as well. And also, honestly, you know, that may not suit every player. It may not suit every player's personality as well. But again, it's, you know, how does it fit? How does it make the team function as a whole? I think you're always, whenever you're putting a team together, you're trying to play to your strengths. There's always going to be a way, you know, the staff talk about a way that you are prepared to lose the game in a quest to try and win it and win it on your terms.
Whose responsibility is it to, and I know this is a buzz term, sort of future-proof the team? I mean, I look at you guys as selectors, and the next series always feels like the most important one. And so then, naturally, you've got an older team. But understandably, if I was picking the team, I would think, I want to put the best players together that I possibly can at this particular point in time to make sure that we're going to win. So is it the responsibility of the States? Is it also you guys, while sort of keeping one eye on the here and now? Whose responsibility is it to make sure that that the team's not just good today, but also good in 5 or 10 years' time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always a focus. And once you go into the crystal ball, I think it's dangerous to assume that it will be perfectly future-proof. And I think it's equally as dangerous to assume that there's going to be this cliff where when you lose, and I get the narrative, because, you know, I think over the last few years, if you put Warner, Smith, Khawaja, Cummins, Hazelwood, Stark, Lyon, you've got guys that are going to come up in conversations for in some of Australia's best ever players and in Australia's best ever team. So yeah, what does that look like when they aren't there for a game or a series, or when they eventually move on from formats or altogether? I think managing expectations that you don't necessarily replace 100 test players with the next bloke who's going to play 100 tests, that I think the vast majority of Australia's 400 and however many test cricketers, if we find a group of players that play 20 to 40 tests, it might be 10, then that gets you through a year or 2 years. And that can be, that can be particularly important at the right time as well, depending on their skill set. So understanding that's not necessarily about unearthing generational talent every time, it is someone who comes in to the Australian cricket team. And then I think we've also, and this is something we're looking into, and the collaboration and working with the States is going to be as critical as it ever has this year. There's no doubt about that with the scheduling that we have. But we're really, really excited around some. We've had a look at Marley Beardman at different times. He's been struck down with a lot of injuries. Callum Vidler's someone who we're really interested in, injured. Jack Edwards is someone who would have played probably more for Australia and is injured again now. There's a litany of those guys that I think have the capacity to build into it. Now, they're fast bowling examples. They're young and injuries, tend to happen. But trying to strike that balance of when they're getting their body physically right, not trying to lose too much time where they're also not being able to develop skill or game sense. So that's a critical bit, I think, around the fast bowling space. I also think the continued investment, and this is probably specifically around subcontinent, but, the MRF program that we've sent players to for a number of years, we've had guys get repeat entries around that. We think that's important, repeat subcontinent exposures, not having guys go to India for 2 weeks and then assuming that in 5 years' time when they go across for a test series that they've got it all laid out. So, an Aussie A series to India again. We had one last year. So some good consistent repeat entries there, MRF development. And again, as you touched on around spin and at different times not seeing as much of that as perhaps we'd like in Shield cricket, but continuing to explore ways that we can still have guys developing and being ready when that opportunity comes. So, I think there's different mechanisms. What does it look like in 5 years? I'm not going to sit here and say that, but I don't subscribe to the theory that it's going to be a drop off cliff.
Last one, just given the age profile of that team, and you really look through this next 18 months, and Usman Khawaja's just got off the roller coaster. Obviously, at the end of the Ashes, it feels like sort of an end point. I find it hard to see when the end point's going to be at any time in the next 18 months, where essentially you go from these test matches up north, to then the tour of South Africa, come back home, play New Zealand, over to India, come back home, the anniversary test, potentially a World Test Championship final, hopefully, and then after that, obviously, the away Ashes. Is there an off-ramp at any stage in that cycle where if you've got a couple of older players that are essentially thinking, right, that's the exit for me, because you feel like if you lose a couple of those senior players, all of a sudden the next glamour series, the next banner series is right on the doorstep. So how do you – I guess the short way of what I'm trying to ask is, do you feel like when you get on – if the players decide, look, we're on the roller coaster for this next cycle, they're on it now for 18 months and they'll play the whole way through until the end of the Northern Ashes?
Yeah, I hope so. I certainly hope they do. I mean, that's back, I guess, to that contract list and the guys that have been performing in Test cricket. I hope that they're there until the end of that Ashes series. I'd throw in a 50-over World Cup, I think, at the end of that as well, which was similar to 2023. I think we had a pretty busy Test schedule leading into that as well. Yeah, there's certain players that have already jumped off certain formats. That's a decision by them to potentially elongate their careers in the Test space. So that's one way of doing it. I think you've seen and will continue to see, particularly the guys that are multi-format players. There will be times that you can't be everything to everyone at all times. So just making sure that at the right time, they do get the opportunity to invest back in. And when you do have a schedule like that, you do at times have to create that. I know it gets reported a lot that someone's been rested from a series, but very always sort of picture someone sitting at home on their couch with a daiquiri and one of those little umbrellas. But, the planning that goes into what players are doing in those periods in terms of, basically prepping for what's coming up next is the key to that. That's part of that's physical, part of that's also mental as well. So I think that'll continue to happen. The nature of the schedule means that's critically important. That's why you sort of get together and try and plan as far out and as deep and as broadly as you need to this far out, so that at the right time you've got guys to cover.
Yeah, but you're not expecting like a spate of retirements, scattered throughout an 18-month window or whatever. It feels like the senior guys are, if they're part of the plan, they're part of the plan through to the Northern Ashes.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, sometimes that can be thrust upon you sometimes by results or injuries. So, they all get thrust together as it's an old group, but within that there's still a vast array of ages, vast array of skill sets, and everyone's body and probably mental capacities at different areas. So it's not a one size fits all. And as we've seen again, not just to cricket but across sport, it's an exciting time to be, because players are playing older and are training smarter and are able to potentially perform at their best or at international standard for longer.
You're a lot closer to it and know a lot more about it than we certainly do here in the press and on the ABC Cricket Podcast. So appreciate your insights as always, George, and thanks for spending the time to take me through it today.
No problems. Cheers.